Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Welcome back to the Marvy Televised for this Monday afternoon, pre-Hanukkah and Christmas. Simon Applebaum back with you live from the Web New York. And first of all, we want to apologize for the technical breakdown, the quick bang that forced our show off the air near the top of the hour. We had blocked our show for 90 minutes. Apparently, somehow, there was a technical cog in the wheel that had us go off after 60. So we apologize for that. And I'm happy to say our guest is about to rejoin us, along with you, and we thank you for your patience with us. So now, joining us live, as promised earlier, from New York, the great executive producer of the brand new Netflix series Soundtrack, Josh Safran. Josh, happy holidays to you. Thanks for hanging with us.
Of course. Hello.
And if you have a question or comment for Josh, make the call 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Josh, how's Soundtrack doing?
I have no idea. We do not get information. There's like you get information a little bit later into the run, but the first few days you don't know. But I hope it's doing well. People seem to like it on Twitter.
Well, reading about it, it sounds like this was your dream project. Originally it was called Mixtape. I understand it originally pitched for Fox, but the format of it and the ambition of it. And you've been around the TV circle for a long time. You were involved with Gossip Girl for a long spell. You created Quantico for the last couple of years and produced that show on ABC. It sounds like this was really your dream project, the one that is it fair to say this is the project you wanted to do all along your TV career?
Well, I don't know about all along because I only came up with it a few years ago, but it definitely feels like a culmination of the things that I love, and it is the most personal thing that I've done, Smash being the other show that I had done. Sort of opened the gateway to me for musicals, and then this is sort of like an amalgamation of sort of a whole bunch of things. But yeah, it's definitely the thing I'm the closest to.
And it also reminds you of the kind of semi-anthology drama that was very big in the 1960s with shows like Route 66, shows like Naked City or East Side, West Side or Wagon Train, where the characters were sort of secondary sometimes to the people they met along the way. In this case, you have this collection of inhabitants of Los Angeles, all of whom are touched by music in some way, and you have different characters in the bunch appear in different episodes. Give us a little more about how the series was formed.
So I'm a very big fan of 30-something, well, pretty much all of those with Zwick and Herskovitz shows. So I kind of actually think that it took me a little while to realize that that had filtered into my brain and had come out a little bit with the Soundtrack. But on 30-something, you know, there was always the two leads, Hope and Michael, and it was their friends and family that sort of revolved around them. But different episodes would follow different characters. But you'd always see Hope and Michael, and there'd be scenes either at their house or in their office, so they'd still be in the story. And I think I really just bounced off of that. I mean, you talk about shows from the 60s. So that, to me, that's a show from the 80s. But, yeah, also, I just love the idea of something anthological, but that actually keeps a spine throughout it. So I think 30-something probably was the most where I gathered my most inspiration. Yeah, and I think that, like, I was really interested in getting to know these characters separately, not just how they interacted with each other, but truly drilling down into them personally, which you don't really see so much anymore in an ensemble show. You see it sort of when it's like The Killing and you're following just two cops. You get a chance to really get into the minds of those people. But I feel like on dramas, it doesn't happen so much.
And how did the show evolve to where you were able to first pitch to Fox and then Netflix picked it up?
So I sold two other pilots a few seasons ago, one to CBS and one to AMC. And then I had this meeting on the books with 20th Century Fox Development. And I went in there anyway, even though they had heard that I'd sold two other pilots, because no one likes to make a third position deal. But they were like, you know what? We love your writing. We want to work with you. We'll make a third position deal with you. What's your dream project? Since if it's in third position, it should just be something that no one else would ever let you do, basically. And I pitched this idea then called Mixtape. And they were like, sold. And then weirdly, it was kind of a blessed process. We took it into Fox first. They bought it in the room. It was the first pilot they picked up to shoot that year. It was the most expensive pilot they made that year. Just along the way, it just was that amazing ball rolling down a hill instead of pushing it up the hill, which is what I was so used to doing. And then ultimately, Fox didn't pick it up after shooting the pilot because it isn't really a Fox show. If you've seen it, it's a little bit. It is a cable or streaming show. It is a little bit edgier, a little bit more personal, a little bit, you know, more unique. And so Fox really loved it, though. The executives there had very much championed it. So they actually let us take it out. They had the rights to hold on to it for, I think it's a year and a half, the cycle. But they still let it go because they really, truly believed in it and believed it would find a home. And within a month, it had sold to Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Now, the series, as we know it, is very interesting because you use music in a couple of ways. One way is that the characters lip sync the songs. The second is that there's a lot of dance, and looking at the trailer, something reminded me of La La Land. It's like this duo that takes place. That it reminded me of the sequence on the hill overlooking Los Angeles and La La Land between Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. And there's a lot of dance in this show. I want to get to that a little bit later, but the way you use music, both as sort of a metaphor for what the characters go through, but also the individual songs that they lip-sync to. How did that come about, and why did you decide to have them lip-sync as opposed to actually sing the actors actually sing the songs?
Well, so I was a very big fan of Pennies from Heaven and actually all of Dennis Potter's work, and I had always wanted to find a way to do an Americanized version, not of Pennies from Heaven, but just of Dennis Potter. You know, there was the MGM musical version of Pennies from Heaven, the feature in 1982 that bankrupted MGM and stopped them making musicals. So maybe it was a bad idea to want to emulate that. But I was always a huge fan of that movie, of his BBC show, of The Singing Detective, of Lipstick on Your Collar. I'd followed all his work, and I really loved that what he did was the characters had these sort of like down on their luck lives, and yet they would lip sync to pop recordings of their era where you could see their hopes and dreams. So I truly just utilized what he had done here. And I'd always wanted to do that because when we listen to a song or when we hear a song in our heads, we hear the artist, we don't hear ourselves. Somebody tweeted recently that they felt like the show gave them that feeling of when they were younger and there would be a song on the radio in the car and they would stare out at the world passing them by. And that's what the show felt like. And that's really was well said. And it's kind of what I wanted to evoke, this idea of who is our own soundtrack? Who do we identify with? What is the music that will always bring us back to a memory? And we lock memories into songs all the time. You know, you can hear a song from when you were a kid or even from 5 years ago or from the breakup that you went through, and I can just send you right back. And so I was not interested in actually having the actors cover because what I wanted to do was evoke that feeling of what the actual song brings you. And that was just baked in from the very beginning. I don't think the show would be what it is if they were doing covers. It just isn't meant to be that. It's meant to play the soundtrack of their lives, not the songs of their lives.
Yeah. And if you've never seen, by the way, both of those shows by Dennis Potter, who is one of the most brilliant writers that ever stepped into a television world, do see them. Pennies from Heaven and Sing Detective. Maybe YouTube has them. I don't know who does now, but I saw them when they originally ran on public television, and they are extraordinary shows. And the movie version with Steve Martin, by the way, and Brenda Peters, is really an underrated gem, with a great dance number, by the way, by Christopher Walken.
So good.
That really showcased him really super. You mentioned that you worked on Smash, which was certainly one of the most ambitious shows done in recent years. How did you apply what you used on Smash, the greatness of it, the worth of it, and how did you apply that to doing soundtrack?
So I took over as a showrunner for season two of Smash, and I learned so much. I mean, that show not only was it ambitious in its scope of what it was trying to do, it was also ambitious in that it was a very large budget and had a lot of moving pieces. I mean, it was basically weirdly like doing Game of Thrones or a show as big as that for HBO. It doesn't matter that it was on NBC. It really took a lot. So I was allowed to dream big on Smash within reason. I mean, there were like 10 executive producers, so that was a little bit of a quagmire. But I was able to try some things and sort of workshop stuff. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. So I really did take those lessons into soundtrack. For instance, there's a musical number in episode 2 of my season of Smash that really does not work and did not work. And I knew it didn't work on the day, and I knew it didn't work in post, and I asked for it to not to not air. I took it out of the episode, but I was instructed to put it back in. And it did air, and it's really not an it just didn't work. And yet, I used that concept in Soundtrack because I learned why it didn't work in Smash, and I was able to apply it in Soundtrack. So it was a musical sequence that involved rigs and harnesses and green screen, almost like an action sequence, but done on a TV budget in a TV set lots of dance. And I was able to do that same thing in Soundtrack in a couple places. We had a couple of sequences with green screen and multiple dancers and multiple rigs, and that I would not have been able to pull those off if I had not had that experience in Smash. So that's just one area. Another area is I learned what songs I could or could not get in Smash, and I applied that when coming up with the song palette for Soundtrack. And, you know, just by nature, also, weirdly, the inverse, I had so much more money on Smash than I had on Soundtrack, and yet I think in some ways Soundtrack looks more expensive, and I think that was because Smash allowed me to learn where that money was well spent and where it wasn't well spent, and I apply those to Soundtrack, those lessons.
Is there a particular song or sequence from an episode that you particularly like that sort of says, this is what we're out to do, this represents what this show is all about, both the song and how it showcases the characters?
Well, it's funny, you know, there's three different types of song sequences in Soundtrack. Every episode has them, except for episode 6, when I had to cut the music because we had to make a budget cut. There's what we call a fantasy sequence where you fully go into the character's head at 7 o'clock, and when you come out of the song, it's still 7 o'clock. There's also the daydream sequences, which is you're in the character's head, but they're actually in the real world. So if they start singing at 7, when they end, it's 7:03. And then there's a combination where time passes, but we're in a fantasy, and every episode has one of those. So I'd say my favorite fantasy sequence has to be the first number on the show, Elastic Heart, because it really says, like, you learn so much about that character and her, not only her personal history, but her emotional history, in a way that no scene could tell you without major exposition. And I just love that sequence where the character of Nelly looks at all of her romantic relationships in her life, going all the way back to her first kiss, and how she has been pushed down literally and physically and emotionally and used and not been her strongest self. So I feel like that sequence is the best version of the fantasy. The best version of the daydream sequence is Both Sides Now in episode 4, as sung by the characters of Margot and Frank, Nellie's parents, in which we use Judy Collins' version of Both Sides Now for the character of Margot when she was younger, the Neil Diamond version of Both Sides Now for Campbell Scott's character when the 20 years later, basically 15 years later, and then the Joni Mitchell version that she recorded when she was in her 60s of Both Sides Now for Madeline Stowe's character, aged in 30 years have passed. And so doing that sequence with the same song and looking at those three verses through someone's life and their relationship, it not only does the song help the story, but the story helps the song, and I just think it's absolutely beautiful. And then as regards our daydream/fantasy, you know, I'm a very big fan of pretty much all of those sequences, but I would say the end of episode 5 between Marianne Jean-Baptiste and Jamil French's characters, where she throws Dante out of the house, that sequence is incredibly emotional and powerful, and the two songs we mashed up together there are really, you know, fantastic.
You have a very interesting cast in Soundtrack. Kelly Hernandez is a singer-songwriter as well as an actress. You got Jenna Dewan, who is a marvelous dancer, coming off her wonderful hosting role on World of Dance. She's also about to do the new Fox series, Pretty Dancing, whose executive producer we will have on our show on Friday. You have Marianne Jean-Baptiste, who is an Oscar-nominated Best Supporting Actress. You mentioned Campbell Scott. So you have a very interesting range of people involved. So when you're doing dance numbers with any or all these folks, first of all, who is your choreographer? And secondly, what orders or what guidance did you give the choreographer to work with these people, whether or not they had dance training?
So we only have one choreographer, James Alsop, and she is really extraordinary. She's one of Beyonce and Lady Gaga's choreographers. And the way that it worked with James, and she was very much my creative partner from pretty much day one of this project, even when we shot the pilot for Fox,
James and I made this decision that she would always choreograph based on the actor's ability and not here's a dance that's right for the sequence and then you're going to learn it. So we fit the moves around the actor's abilities. And in this way, you really do feel like it's that character's expression. So some of the actors who maybe weren't as skilled as dancers, we used that. And then some of the other cast members who were the greatest dancers in the world, like Robbie Fairchild of the New York City Ballet and An American in Paris and Cats, he's one of the leads of Cats right now, you know, we used his ability. He plays the character of Troy. So it just was, it really fit. It fit the story to be an expression of the actual character, and it fit the way James worked. So what was amazing was you'd have Madeline Stone, Campbell Scott dancing a tango in episode 4, sort of a fracture tango, and it was made to fit them, and they were amazing. But then you'd have Jenna Dewan, who's basically a machine who could dance 24 hours a day and be fucking perfect. Sorry, excuse my language. And it was incredible. Like both sides of that. Seeing both of that was incredible. And James just did an amazing job with that.
What are the sort of things, you mentioned that you're already starting to get some social media reaction. What are they saying about the show? Are they giving you ideas? Are they giving you any ideas of like how they see the characters, not just you see the characters evolving, but how they see the characters evolving from episode to episode?
Well, so what's been really interesting for me is this is my first experience with a binge release, and I have to say it's uncomfortable for me because I have worked exclusively in a broadcast manner with 22 to 25, even Smash was 17, you know, episodes a year. So I'm very used to feedback rolling in as it comes, and also being able to listen to that feedback, you know. You're making a show, and if like on Gossip Girl, if the audience doesn't like a couple that you put together, you're pretty much got 7 or 8 episodes ahead of you, but you can still rewrite the ship if you need to. This is just, it is what it is, and it's out there. And so what happens is I'm getting feedback, but it's generalized because people are binging. So they'll talk about the show and they'll talk about some of the characters, but they won't mention the moments that matter to them or the sequences that they loved. And I do kind of miss that feedback. I do think if this episode had gone out weekly, people would be discussing what happened in the episodes, and I'd be able to like follow that discussion and really sort of like learn. But instead, people are watching, which I'm grateful for, but they're watching all 10 at once or at all 10 over 2 days. And then the feedback is, I just watched all the soundtrack. Here's what I thought in 140 character tweets. So I'm noticing is, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. What were you noticing?
I'm noticing that, like, really, it's the similar thing that happened with the critics that reviewed the show. People either buy into the lip syncing or they don't. And if they, and that's really the only criticism. Everyone loves the story and the narrative and the actors and the direction. It's just a question of whether people can handle the lip syncing or not. And it's been really fascinating. And it's like, I understand that it was a risky move. Like, it's interesting to watch the feedback. So a lot of people have to either get over that hump or decide that it's not for them or just love it from the top. And I've been seeing that. Like, that every tweet is like, just started soundtrack, don't know what I think. Just started soundtrack, wow, this lip syncing is insane. Just started soundtrack, like, I never seen lip syncing before. So, like, that's really what's coming up. Excuse me, more than anything.
When you were assembling, Josh, your writing team and your directors for this, were there certain guidelines you were working at? For example, I want writers who can bring their personal experiences to the table. Or I want directors that may have a background with dance directing or with music or music video directing or something that they can expand their range, if you will. I mean, I'm sure it's your modus operandi in terms of bringing your writers and directors together to do this with you.
So with the writers, my goal was I really wanted playwrights and I wanted my writer's room to be to represent the show. So we had a lot of writers of color and queer writers. And again, mainly, like I said, mainly playwrights, because I really wanted to get into the characters more deeply than I had before. So that was the goal of the room. I knew enough about, like, musicals, it's in my blood, and I studied it, and, like, so I didn't need anyone who had a musical background. I needed people who reflected the characters and their lives and their experiences. With the directors, we decided, Beth Schachter, who was my number two, and myself, decided to go after directors who either had music video experience or who had sort of like intimate character drama experience. So our directors pretty much fall directly down that line. Jesse Peretz, who directed the pilot, actually has done both. he's made a bunch of music videos. He was in a band in the, you know, 90s. So he called the Lemonheads. So, and then he directed a bunch of music videos before he started directing Girls and Shrill and, you know, so many shows that, that were sort of like great character pieces. Then we would have directors like Ty West and Joe Swanberg, who were indie film directors who had had a loose way of working, but really got into character, really got into like the mood and the emotions of the characters. And that was the goal there. Then we had directors like Darren Grant and Karen Gaviola. Karen is a, you know, DGA board member. She is like a director who's worked forever, but she really knows her way around action, which in our minds is very similar to music. Karen's done so much action, whether it's Lucifer, Hawaii 5-0, Magnum, whatever it is, she understood the musical sequences like a true action filmmaker can. And Darren had done a bunch of music videos, Destiny's Child, so many bands, and was also a very established TV director. So just, and then there was me, I directed an episode. So it really was a lovely mix that really hit all of the corners that we needed. And the weird nature of the show was we shot two episodes at a time out of sequence. So the directors, when they came to us, they were with us for 6 weeks to 2 months at a time, and they would overlap. So it became like a real family, and directors really hunkered down. It was like making features. It was not like making television. It was really lovely. Like, there was one day on set, which has never happened to me before, where all five directors were there. And that, like, was an amazing experience because we all had each other's back, so we could all talk to each other and make it all work. It was great.
Did you say Joe Swanberg was one of your directors?
Yes, Joe directed two episodes, episode 4 and episode 7.
Because Joe was the creator of another Netflix series. It was an anthology show called Easy, which also dealt with relationships of love in Chicago. We had him on the program, by the way, a number of years ago when that was on. Very talented person, writer and director. And it's very interesting that I'm wondering if he brought that experience of Easy to his episodes on Soundtrack.
Well, what I found, Joe was one of the first people that I hired. He was somebody that I very much wanted to work with, and I definitely wanted to work with on this. And he had never been brought anything like this. His way of filmmaking is very loose, very improvised, very get everybody together. It's an Altman-esque way of doing things. And my style of filmmaking is more formal. You know, you have the script, and I see things as sort of shot more formally, like not a lot of handheld, if at all, you know, not a lot of improv, obviously. But I thought that we would mesh, and we talked a bunch and met before he came on to do the show. And I really think that what he brought was this level of looseness, this ability to play. And also he's got so many hours of films under his belt that he just understood it. And then what I could bring to it was this formalism, this Dennis Potter style of shooting where, you know, things looked like a feature from the 80s, you know. And so together it matched so well. He was a joy to have on set. The actors loved him. I loved him. I was with him every single day. I learned so much from him. He might have learned a little from me just as regards shooting basically network television, you know, broadcast television. And it was just a great collaboration. I was very grateful to have that. So yeah, he brought what he brings. Like, everyone gets so comfortable around Joe. You know, you just feel like you're in this troupe. And that was really wonderful, especially because his episodes were the first episodes we shot. Like I said, we shot out of sequence. So 4 and 7 were first up. So he sort of created that tone. And it was truly the greatest working experience I've ever had, cast and crew and set. It was just, I don't think I'll ever have this again. Every single one of the cast, the crew, we all hung out together. We all were friends. We all still get together at the drop of a hat. We had two premieres, one in New York and LA 2 weeks ago. And then we still all got together this past Wednesday. Like, it's a amazing experience. It's been an amazing experience.
Yeah. While we wait to see if Netflix gives you a second season for Soundtrack, I understand 2020 is going to be a big year for you because you're going to bring back Gossip Girl on HBO Max. And I understand there's also an AMC pilot that you're working on that they may be high on.
Yes. 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 That's been, weirdly, that pilot was one of those first two pilots I sold before I sold Mixtape. So it's been 2.5 years, and they've been very, very, very lovely waiting for me because they do care about that show so much, and I do too. It is also as unique and ambitious as Soundtrack, but without a musical element. It's a supernatural story, and I'm very excited to dive into that. And then Gossip Girl, yes, the writer's room is 13 weeks in out of 20. We start production in January, pre-production in January. We start shooting in March. I'm in New York City right now, that's going to definitely be also a trip because it is the HBO version of Gossip Girl, And so that's going to be exciting and nerve-wracking. It's just everything's about, like, you know, 20% bigger.
The program is Soundtrack, and you can see it right now on Netflix. If you have a smart TV set or smart TV device, chances are Netflix is right where you are 24/7, so do check it out. And for more details about the program online, go to www.netflix.com. It's www.netflix.com. And once again, the new version of Gossip Girl will premiere late next year on HBO Max, which will be there on smart TV sets and smart TV devices starting in May. Exact premiere date to be announced. Josh Safran, the creative executive producer of Soundtrack, congratulations on getting this project off the ground. I've seen the trailer. It looks like a winner. I have a hunch that it's going to be the beginning of a great long run for that show. So congratulations on making it happen. Thank you for making extra time with us. All the very best to you with Gossip Girl and the other projects from 2020. And we would love to have you back anytime. It's been a terrific treasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Have a great holiday, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. All the greatest to you and your Soundtrack cast and crew for a wonderful holiday and a super new year.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Josh Safran, creator executive producer of Soundtrack on Netflix, joining me live here in New York. Once again, for more details, www.netflix.com. And that will do it for this edition of Tomorrow Be Televised. I want to thank all of our guests for being here and all of you for tuning in. We have two more live episodes coming your way, day after and day after Christmas. On Thursday, my guest will be the chief executive officer of a very unique venture called Storytellus, Rutger Berning. We'll talk to him about where he sees TV going in 2020 and what some of the big stories of TV 2019 were. And on Friday, we will have, as promised, the executive producer of the new Fox series starring Janet Dewan, Flirty Dancing. Mike Yurchik will be with us. Also on Friday, we'll have our annual feature, Tomorrow Be Televised Remembers, where we celebrate the people in front of and behind the camera who passed away this year. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And check out the podcast version. It's available on iTunes, Apple TV, Spreaker Podcast app, iHeartRadio.com, and some episodes at www.mediaghost.com. And remember, that's also where you can find any or all of our episodes this year. We love having you with us. Let us know what you think about the program. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at UBCSimonPWBC. Remember, we love hearing from you because what you say matters now more than ever. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not those of the Blog Talk Radio speaker and iHeartRadio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Andy Toews, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of this enterprise are Alan Levy and Bob Sharish. Tomorrow Be Televised is brought today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. If you're still looking for a great holiday gift that lasts a lifetime, go to audibletrial.com/televised and get 3 free audiobooks and a 1 month trial. But Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. All of us at Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and iHeartRadio wish you a very happy Hanukkah if you start celebrating tonight, and a very Merry Christmas, and a wonderful Kwanzaa or any other holiday you celebrate this week. If you're leaving, by the way, to go to your loved ones, please make your trip safe and make it great. And come back here on Thursday at our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and iHeartRadio. Until next time. Stay well, stay tuned, happy Hanukkah, and Merry Christmas, everyone!